Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We're not even going to grace any of your complaints with airtime, even though I'm doing that right now. Look, you know, we said at the top of part one, which was, what, 2 months ago now, Raj, was it?
Is that how long it's been already?
I don't know, maybe. Jesus. We said we pod when we want, but, you know, here we are. Listen or don't, you know? Come on. How you doing, mate?
Yeah, not too bad. Just busy, cracking on. Doing grown-up shit.
Are you writing another book yet?
Not yet, no. I'm still not fully mentally recovered from doing the last one. But I'll, you know, eventually, hopefully.
I genuinely don't know how you did that. Not as in, like, I'm doubting your ability to do that. Was no casual side eye there from me. You know, I'd be much more upfront about that sort of thing nowadays.
Yeah.
But the actual process to do that, mate, is... pretty mammoth. I don't think I've congratulated you probably enough on that, so I'll do it now.
A very lonely time where you sit alone for
mate, you sounded so dejected as you actually said that as well.
No, it's not a fun thing to do. It's one of those things when you do it the first time, you don't really know what you're getting yourself in for. When you do it a second time, then I think you can sort of prepare yourself for what you need to do and perhaps organise yourself a bit better for how you're going to attack it.
Is it self-flagellation, isn't it, that you know, there's like funny sects of monks do when they like whip their own backs
and shit and tie spikes onto their thigh and shit.
It's kind of like the writer's equivalent of that, right?
Yeah, especially with sort of the amount of time that we give ourselves to do it as well, because town was so busy as a club and we wanted to get it out before Christmas, but the after they'd been promoted. So it was essentially, you know, all done within 6 months when if you ever actually have a look at how most people books are, they work on them for about 2 years and then they come out a year after that. So it's a 3-year turnaround. And I did the entire thing in, you know, a quarter of that time, if not less. It was something, but like I say, you live and you learn and you put that into practice for the next time you have a crack at it.
Something Spurs this time then, mate, yeah?
We'll see. There's so many Tottenham things that I don't know. I might do something a bit more general. There's an idea I've had that I wanted to do first, actually, but I never had the chance to, and I'll see if I can do that again, but I'll keep that to myself just in case that I don't do that and it's something else.
I'll happily let you write a book about your time spent podcasting with the, you know, infamous Tetrunk, you know.
That'll be done under a pseudonym.
If you want to see that, it'll be.
But I've got to get rid of the
NDA. It's the story everybody wants to hear.
It's a bit like working with Donald Trump. I feel like Stormy Daniels. I've got all these stories about you, but I'm not allowed to tell anyone.
There are literal, kind of semi-literal NDAs as well, aren't there, on some discussions we've had. So
I think they're mutual though, so
yeah, fair. Segueing from Huddersfield, because I think we've got a nice one here, because I saw you talking about this on Twitter the other day. Let's just dive in quickly before we do some questions about the ticket price increase at Spurs.
Because
it's something that, you know, There's a lot of conversation about, and I'd be interested to hear your perspective first, sort of from the town thing, basically, in the fact that, you know, from what I understand, the season tickets there are an absolute fraction of the price that they are for Spurs.
I paid for last season it was 200, for this season it's going to be 250, and that's sort of for a seat bang on halfway, about 5-6 rows up, so there's really no better seat in the house from where we sit.
It's a tidy ground as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's the same architects that made the John Smiths are the ones that are doing the new White Hart Lane. John Smith was actually their first ever project, so it stands them in good stead. It's comparing apples and oranges, to be perfectly frank, because the two sides of the clubs, two sides of the places, and the sort of the socio-economic reality of the two clubs and the two fan bases are completely different. But when I go and watch one team for 250 quid and then I support another, which, is selling tickets for 2,200, it just sort of, it beggars belief that they're playing the same sport, in the same division. But it's one of those things where it's where you see the disparity between the literature that Spurs have put out and the promises and the noises they'd made previously. Perhaps it's just us being naive, but I always thought the intention was that they're going to build this new stadium, they're going to have so many more seats to sell, and they're going to have so many more corporate opportunities within that and outside that, with naming rights and with, NFL tie-ins and shirt sponsors that they've got now, and kit manufacturers and all that shit, and the fact they're going to have all these people in their cheese and wine bars and stuff that they just couldn't have previously, that was going to be able to subsidise affordable ticketing for your average fan.
But they did almost frame it that way, right?
They did.
Correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure they did frame it that way.
Almost entirely they did, yeah. And in fact, the way they actually released their season ticket prices, they did it in exactly the same manner. So they've actually done it really cleverly, where they can give headline prices that seem really affordable and, cheaper than Arsenal and Chelsea, so and so many seats at this price point under £1,000, £795 a year, £800-odd, a year. And they've done it so that they can, the headlines and the clickbait are there for that. But as soon as you scratch the surface and actually look at it and hear real people tell the difference and disparity between what they paid for their exactly the same seat at White Hart Lane and the 50% extra they're suddenly walking up with when they've, been asked to pay for the same one here, it's, a joke. And it's one of those things where when I was tweeting about it and stuff, I always come from this, perspective of, fans being first, and I know people don't like that sometimes because they think it's a bit, leftist or snowflakey, I think in today's parlance is perhaps what they'd say. But that's, that's my outlook on the world, and, Tottenham are in that. And they're a big, major part of that for us. And it felt a bit of a letdown that, this thing that we thought they were going to be able to do, and they seem to be making the right noises to do. And to be honest, building on the goodwill of the new stadium and, the goodwill that is just around the club at the minute for the fact that they're actually good, and it's the first time in many people's lifetimes they've been just this good, it would have been a perfect opportunity to, ramp that up and, be a fantastic PR win and, another off-field win for them. But they've shot themselves in the foot.
Go on, mate, carry on, yeah.
No, you crack on.
I was just going to say, because this is kind of what it is to me, right? If I, we don't make any secret of, politics and such on this, and I know we sort of joke about it and it will piss people off here and there. And I mean, even if I take that kind of step away from it, because what you touched on there is very true with the Huddersfield issue. It's apples and oranges, and there's a lot of factors to take into account there. And I think there's been kind of like, guilty parties in some part. I saw Daniel Sturridge, he wrote actually a really interesting piece about the price of season tickets across different clubs and how it can attract a new generation of fans. And he was kind of talking about Spurs' season ticket stuff and was comparing them with a few clubs, which I saw where he was going. I'm not like calling him out or having a dig or anything, but at the same time, like you say, I think there's a confluence of factors there that make these kind of things a bit different. The fact that Spurs are sort of aspiring to punch at a level with a lot of clubs around them who are still, I think Arsenal still have double the wage bill that we do, for example. Liverpool have more than double the wage bill we do. Chelsea, more than double the wage bill we do. I think Chelsea's is close to triple the wage bill of ours. So, and it really shows you kind of the, again, it should anyway, for anybody that's got any doubt, it should show you the sort of the miraculous job that Spurs are doing, and particularly Pochettino is doing with this current crop of players. But it's a bit of a segue. And I do understand that we need to maximise capital if we want to stay at this type of playing field.
Yeah.
However, the problem for me, where this all starts to fall down, is that I believe, like, it's been sort of bandied about that, like, match day revenue now is, generally speaking, less than 10% of the club's operating profit of any football clubs.
Yeah, with so the television money being as big as it is, it's not the be-all and end-all that it was when Arsenal moved stadium, for example.
Exactly. And an example of this in actual practice is Juventus moving into a new stadium that was actually smaller than their old stadium because they noticed it was more important to have an atmospheric filled stadium for every single game as opposed to a massive stadium that's going to be half empty for games that don't matter in
their, you know, previous whatever. Stadium was state owned as well, so they actually own this one as theirs, so they get more out of less seats as well, which is one of the other thoughts behind it, because a lot of the stadiums in Italy work like that. That's why they have so many ground shares, is that very few of the teams actually own their own ground.
That's interesting. I didn't actually know that.
Yeah, that's you know, AC Milan are looking at sort of building their own version of what Juventus have and what have you, because San Siro is a, you know, a state-owned stadium. Half the money goes to the council and stuff. That's actually how it works in Huddersfield. They've got a three-way split on the stadium between the football club, the rugby club and the council. It's interesting, you know, the point you make about Daniel Starry's piece and the next generation of fans, because that's one thing I've noticed more than anything else with Huddersfield specifically, because I grew up in the town until I was sort of 5 years old, and Huddersfield just weren't on my radar. And it's not just because my dad was a Tottenham fan. I went to school and everything, but the kids there all supported Man United, Liverpool, City, all the big teams. It wasn't as if this football team had any sort of traction with kids. And they weren't bad at the time. They were, you know, a top level championship team when I was growing up. So there's, you know, by rights, they could have grabbed the attention of some of us, but they never did. But these days, because they've lowered the season ticket prices of kids so much and adults and made it affordable, they have secured that next level of supportership and that next generation, because you walk through the town now and kids have all got their town shirts on. That you hardly ever see the big clubs. Of course, you still see the odd Man United shirt, the odd Chelsea and Arsenal and what have you, because they're everywhere. But they've got more town than there ever has been before. There's more pride in the team. There's more access to the team. And that ground, to be honest with you, a couple of seasons ago, when David Wagner was first hired, because he's only been there, this is only his second full season in charge, it was, you know, sort of a third to a half, you know, empty most games. But when they lowered the season ticket price and sort of tied it in with them playing better football, that's what helped generate the current level of atmosphere and enthusiasm.
This is it, right? This is where people would jump in and say, well, it helps now that they're in the Premier League that the attendance is up. And I do take that to a degree.
However, I don't think they would be in the Premier League had they not dropped the season ticket prices.
But this is it. This is what you've got to see, is it? Like, and you touched on it previously as well in relation to Spurs, is that I think it's a very myopic view that the club are taking, that Spurs are flying at the moment, but all it takes is a couple of missteps. All it takes is Pochettino going to PSG and taking Kane with him, you know, and we could conceivably be Spurs again, you know?
Football's
it's a house of cards built on sand, right?
Yeah,
as we've seen with Manchester United, you know, Fergie left and even an empire such as United has pretty much crumbled now. Yeah, right. I know that sounds ridiculous to say they're sitting second in the league and they won the Europa League last year, but come on, this is Man United that won however many doubles, Champions Leagues, the league, the FA Cup, everything for two decades solid, and it almost overnight fell to pieces. So the fact that
They're a tourist attraction now.
Well, yeah, that people can't see that could happen to Spurs so much easier it's astonishing to me. And this now is the chance to capitalise on the fact that we are successful, get in that new generation of fans. Because what I will say is, generally speaking, as a 33-year-old man, I still look around when I go to Spurs games, and I'm probably one of the younger people there still. I honestly feel that. On average, I'm still one of the younger people there.
That's as much to do with pricing as anything else, though, because the average age and demographic of people who go to football now are people who only go for one game because they're in London on holiday, or they're sort of 40-year-old white men at their youngest, because they're the people with the most disposable money. I mean, me and you were joking about it in the text the other day that the only people who can afford to go to Spurs week in, week out are divorced dads, but that they're the only people with that sort of disposable money. You know, to be able to pay $2,500 for something. There are people I know who've got very, very good jobs and, you know, very high, well-paying roles, but they're going to have to think twice about taking up their same seat again, because the price hikes, that's just that much. And, you know, Spurs are in a very lucky position right now where I imagine they could take the piss and sell their season tickets for $5,000 a pop in that stadium right now, and they'd probably sell it out because they're that much of an attraction. But you're right, as soon as that sort of goes away, then they become Tottenham again, and you may have lost people to lesser teams because they can actually afford to go and have a relationship with them than the ones you could have got in now. So it's one of those things where it's not unexpected, but it's disappointing. And I think I'd highlight the work the Trust have done at this point as well, because they've been fantastic. The statements and everything they've put out have all been, you know, pitched and written perfectly, I think. And with so many people that sort of got back to me and what have you, saying, oh, we expected it to be, you know, this much money, I'm happy to pay more because, you know, my seat's gone up 20%, but the stadium's gone up 50%, so I'm paying for what I've got and what have you. That's nice for them, and I'm really happy for them that they've got the money to do it, but they're in a minority there. And it sometimes helps to have a wider perception of things to, you know, get your head around it rather than just sort of seeing it from your own personal view sometimes.
Yeah, and I do think as well, something I sort of do hasten to jump in on is that I tweeted something to this effect the other day as well. I don't fully aim all the vitriol at Spurs here. I don't think this is Spurs who are an aberration in any sense. Like, I think this is a football wide, this is a problem with football and the culture and business, I guess, in general at the moment.
Tottenham had the chance to be better than that, though. I think that's the point. And the fact that they decided to, if you can't beat them, then join them rather than doing their own thing, I think is the disappointing part of it. And again, maybe we're just being naive and idealist, and that doesn't sound, you know, entirely away from RMO, but you know, you feel the way you feel at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, just to reiterate the point that I think that, you know, for all the kind of fancy sponsors and all that that they get in, all these big shots from the NFL from America. But do you know what I mean? All these multi-million pound sponsorship deals that we have with far-flung kind of insurance companies that nobody's ever heard of, and hedge funds, and, you know, Toilet Duck or whoever else we slap on the stadium.
Yep.
But what, and I know this is kind of soppy rhetoric, but what makes Spurs and what makes a club and what makes the sport is the people that go and attend the matches and are there constantly and have a firm connection with the club. Mm. And if you start losing that connection to actual people, what's the point? What's even the point of any of this, because then all you're doing is having a stadium that's full of people who work for these brands that sponsor the club that don't care either way. They don't care either way if they're there. They're there to watch Harry Kane score a goal, but they don't really care if Harry Kane scores or not on the level that they're affiliated with Spurs. It's just to say on their Instagram, went and saw that Harry Kane lad today, is part of my extracurricular thing I get with my cushy job. You know, it's, and it's, that's kind of what a lot of the sport is becoming. And it's just, it's a shame. And I get it. It's a reality. It's a modern reality of a lot of things, that the kind of joy has been sucked out of it by money, but you know, hopefully we will persevere and, see the Levy break somehow. And hopefully a lot of it, I mean, it's not to sound too defeatist. I think the Trust, like you say, are doing sort of sterling work at the moment. Hopefully that dialogue between the club and the fans can continue. Should we go on to some of the questions you're saying we've got in, mate?
You can do, yeah. I was just going to make the other point is cool. That we can't forget that Tottenham's in the poorest borough in the capital either. And it sort of flies in the face of trying to regenerate the area and, you know, put schools in place and do all the community work when, you know, by rights, the lifeblood of the team, as you say, should be the people who are there. And if you're pricing out the people on your doorstep, then maybe you need to have a look at yourself. But, you know, I'm sure we'll rumble on this conversation as more things happen and what have you. We'll catch up on it in 2 months.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've got loads of questions. Shall I read them out?
Go on then.
The first one we've got, I'll find a football one first. Here's one from, it's a nasty one, this. It's one of those where Sophie's Choice type things, which I don't always enjoy, but I'll make you answer it. Robbie Donnellan, I believe is how you say it. If the footballing gods offered Spurs a Premier League title over the next 5 years on the condition that we sold Kane this summer, would you accept it?
I mean, see, this is the thing, because it's always it always falls down onto, well, do we win more titles if we have Kane in the team? But I'm assuming the way this has been pitched is that we keep Kane and don't win the league, and
yeah, I sell think that's, Kane that's and what, win the league. If we read between the lines, yeah.
If we read between the lines and take it that way, then you know, I don't know. It's just it's so unpleasant. I mean, I was talking about this not long ago, and I honestly don't mean this in the hyperbolic sense for once, that to me, Harry Kane is actually priceless. The only circumstance we should sell Harry Kane is if we're doing right by him, is if he has come to us earnestly and said, look guys, I love this club, but I want to win stuff. We're sinking down back into sixth, seventh place. Everybody above us has got too much spending power. I don't want to go to City. I'll go to Real or PSG. But, you know, I work my ass off and I need to win something. I've got to do it. I want to win the Champions League or what have you. I understand selling him in that circumstance to do right by the lad. If he, you know, because you kind of feel Kane's the sort of player. Yeah, exactly. I'm sure we'd be compensated accordingly for that. But if it's a case of like, you know, Kane's happy to stay and we get offered 200 mil by Man City, no. And I know people say, oh, but 200 mil, we could buy Icardi and we could, but that's not, you can't guarantee, number one, you cannot, on a base level, you can't guarantee the return of goals that Harry Kane gives us. You can't guarantee anybody that is going to have the same affinity with the club, with the fans that he does. So he's absolutely priceless. But framing it in the context of this, do I want to see Spurs win the Premier League? Well, yes, of course I do. However, I've waited over 20 years now to see Spurs win anything other than the League Cup. And we haven't. Like, I was a bit too young to remember 1991.
I wasn't even born, man.
Yeah. I was, what, six?
Yeah.
So, I sort of remember a vague, hazy image of my dad being happy, but that's probably even something my mind has created itself, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
So, to see Spurs win it within the next 5 years? Well, no, because maybe we can keep Kane and win it within the next 10 years, because I think that's our trajectory anyway, with the new ground, with everything that's going. So, yeah, no, that was my roundabout way of saying no, keep Harry Kane, you bastards.
Next one's from Ben Foreman. If you had to replace Pochettino with another manager tomorrow, who would it be and why?
No, I don't even... Where do you even begin with that?
I don't know.
You know, like, we've gone through so many managers. Like, what can you, you know, what, Simeone? Because he's sort of similar. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, what? Who else?
I don't know. It's a really tough question. I don't think Pochettino's done at the club yet. I think there'll probably be, there will come a natural breaking point at some stage where he can either decide to stay and go, you know, this is where I'm going to be for the next 5 to 10 years. And I think that'll be in a season or two's time. Or he will leave and he'll go, I'm going to try and test my hand elsewhere.
Or alternatively, the wheels fall off and we sack him, you know, because that can happen as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Are we past that point now with him? He's been there, what, 4 seasons now? He's been there longer than Redknapp now, hasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, if there's some
sort of... Is this the longest somebody's been boss of Tottenham in our lifetime? It's quite possible, isn't it?
That's a good question. That's a very good question.
I'll have a look. Anyway.
Let's have a think.
I'll pull up the...
Collectively David Pleat over the spread of,
we've got David Pleat to fucking thank for our team at the minute.
Yeah, Chibomba and the likes.
Well, he can't pronounce anybody's names. He thinks his name's Dali Ali, but he fucking scoured him.
Actually, I believe we have Tim Sherwood to thank for our team at the moment.
Oh, we've actually got a question here from Ross H. Would you bring back the death penalty for Tim Sherwood? I think that's too kind. I'd like keep him in a cell, Fritzl style cell, just without the sex, and feed him very little, and just torture him.
I'd feed him videos of just like Pochettino delivering post-match presses in Spanish.
Paulinho highlights from Barcelona.
Yeah. Oh, God. No, he's still not good.
He's still shit. When he played in that Chelsea game, was it Chelsea that they had where he started? Yeah, and he was dog shit.
Yeah,
he got hooked at half time.
He is not.
He's just shitter in a better team.
Yeah, he is. He's not good. I won't stand for it.
He isn't. But did you see that Tim Sherwood interview that he did where he sort of, sucked himself up again?
Yeah, he sort of, you know, self-aggrandizing, I found Harry Kane bullshit, but it's not the case. He got his debut under Redknapp. He played under AVB, you know, like, just, I don't know. I don't understand it to a degree. Sherwood gave Kane his first starts and stuff, but it was in a time when...
But he makes it sound as if he did, that was his first act. As soon as he got given it, Harry Kane starts up front. It wasn't. Well, it was fucking 3 or 4 games at end of season, you cunt.
And also, let's be real about this. Like, and this is the sort of thing that oddly people aren't talking about. It's very easy to drop a Soldado who was as fucked as he was when Kane came in. We're not talking about... Sherwood didn't make some brave fucking statement by dropping Soldado who was maybe had a similar sort of return as, say, a Chadli had back then. Do you know what I mean? An average to fair kind of goal return where you would still probably say he's not scoring enough, perhaps, but he's still doing a job. He didn't drop a Soldado like that. He dropped a Soldado who could barely come on the pitch without bursting into tears. The guy was that mentally affected.
Yeah, he was broken.
He was absolutely broke. The guy scored a goal and burst into tears. Like, I'm not saying that in a nasty way. You know,
I still have an awful lot of affection for him.
Of course. But what I mean is, the guy was, you know, he had personal issues going on. He was just being affected by his form and whatever the chicken and egg is in that kind of scenario. We can only speculate, but the guy was not in a happy place. It was quite clear to see. And we had Adebayor, who was, I believe, injured, inconsistent, not really getting on even with Sherwood by that point either.
Yeah.
And so Harry Kane naturally came in. And he took the chance with both hands. Yeah, of course he did. But isn't that down to him? I don't know. That it just seems to me that even Pochettino now, and I don't even think he's doing it in that, like, you know, try hardy, oh no, it wasn't me way. Pochettino to me seems fiercely defensive of Harry Kane's own endeavour, in that whenever anybody kind of frames it to Pochettino as in, like, you know, you've helped develop this player a long way, it, to me at least, it always seems that Pochettino's always quick to be like, this is on this kid, like, this guy, he makes himself undroppable to me, you know?
Yeah.
And he's always kind of maintained that line. And you see people like Inglethorpe who have spoken about this in the past. Like, Bankrupt Spurs, I'm sure you'll follow him anyway, has got a very good thread where he's picked this whole Sherwood article apart. You know how much he revels in his Sherwood bashing, but he's completely just destroyed us in it. Like, Inglethorpe and a lot of the other people involved behind the scenes have always been very, very quick to highlight how much it's come from Harry Kane bashing down their doors at the end of it. That sounds a bit dodgy, doesn't it? But still, bashing down their doors at the end of every training, being like, come on, boss, can we go back out and I work, you know, can work on shooting for a bit longer, or I can work on my left foot for a bit longer, or I can work on my heading. You know, it's the guy, come on, every episode we descend into loving Harry Kane, but he makes it too easy, doesn't he?
Yeah, there are no words. One interesting tweet I saw about this yesterday was you remember Roberto, who used to be the social media manager at Tottenham and worked within the club, he had a couple of very interesting tweets about it, about the piece. He said that, I'll read out his tweets verbatim because I've just pulled them up now because I don't want to misquote him. He said, just seen the piece, and it's funny how things in hindsight are often different to how they actually were. You know, that was an under-21s team that won the under-21s league at a canter, smashing most teams comfortably. And, you know, it appeared as if that, you know, Chris Ramsey was the brains at the time. And he went on to say, he's a fraud in my view. I remember a very esteemed ex-manager, director of football and coach who were very pro-Spurs actually putting in a complaint about him after one under-21s game because he was unprofessional on the touchline. But I guess just play him seems a good point of view. And somebody somebody says to him, I'm guessing that's Pleat. And he goes, I couldn't possibly say. So I imagine, you know, it was. So if there's people at the club who thought he was a bell end while he was actually doing well, the stories about how he got into the position he was in and what have you, of the reason why so many people dislike him and don't ever want him associated with the club ever again. And, you know, he's been a shit show wherever he's gone since. You know, Villa, he helped take them down after saving them by the skin of his teeth one season because they were just shitter teams in the league at that point. And Swindon, he made a joke of that as well. He was like an almost weird dictatorial director of football there who kept picking the team.
Bizarre.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
And he's not been touched since for good reason, I think. And, you know, every sort of 6 months to a year, we're probably going to get one of these self-aggrandizing Sherwood pieces until he's given a League One job or something, or a Championship club gets desperate enough to bring him in. But other than that, he's, you know, he's a wart on the arse of Tottenham's history.
He is, yeah.
We've got one question from JDK on Toby Alderweireld. He's on sort of just a stalemate over his contract. Do we have any thoughts on that?
It seems, I mean, my overall thought at the moment is I get the feeling that, yeah, this is a bit of a retelling of the Kyle Walker stuff, right? He's kind of in that place now where there's some sort of weird contract stuff going on and he's sort of half injured, half fit, but you also get the feeling that maybe he could have kind of figured in a few more games than he actually has. It just seems to be reaching that conclusion, doesn't it? That, I mean, I personally, I don't feel that something like this is all just going to be about money. I feel that there's... So, for example, let me reframe this a bit better. Like, if we've heard in the past that players like Eric Dier have had sort of issues with their contract, we know Hugo Lloris has maybe had some issues with his contract. We know that even, I think, Harry Kane has softly sort of aired some stuff about his contract in the past couple of seasons, which he has every right to do.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a red line for Pochettino to like throw his toys out the pram with a player and say, you know, oh, how dare you ask for more money.
No matter what job you're in, if you think you're worth more money, then you've every right to ask for it.
Of course. And if Toby Alderweireld is on 80k a week in today's market, yeah, he definitely is worth more money. So I think he could be forgiven for wanting more. So I'm never going to adopt that line of like, oh, this is a disgrace. How dare he ask for more money? But if, from my perspective, at least, I get the idea that, you know, given Pochettino's sort of approach to this stuff, that this is probably more of a issue with Alderweireld intimating that his heart's not really in it anymore, that he wants success now. He's coming towards the end of his career and he wants to win the Champions League, or he wants to win the league and probably wants to go and play for City or somebody like that. You know, I wouldn't be overly surprised for him to end up at City. If they come in this summer and offer us 50 million like they did with Walker, he's, I could probably see us selling to him. Boy, he's only got a year left though, hasn't
he?
Yeah,
that's true.
That's the problem.
So did Van Dijk, and he went for, what, 75?
Yeah. But I think anywhere between 50 to that sort of money, 50 to 75, I reckon we'd probably sell him. I'd probably see him going to City, maybe to United. Hopefully it'll go to PSG. Hopefully we've kind of created some sort of sweetener there with, you know, Aurier, Moura. Perhaps they're probably thinking they can take somebody like Alderweireld. And I'd sooner sell, if the option was 50 mil to City or 40 mil to PSG, I definitely know where I'd rather flog him. But in my perspective, at least, it seems like a fairly toxic union now. And I can't really see it ending any other way than Alderweireld leaving us this summer, to be honest.
Yeah, that seems about right. There could still be, you know, out of the blue, him maybe sat there, yeah, with his arm, Pochettino with his arm around him and stuff. There's still a place for him within the team. But yeah,
we said this about Vertonghen a couple of years ago, right? Mm. You know, so
I think with Jan now, he's here for life.
Big time.
It would hurt me to see him go at this point. He's more important to me.
He's honestly, and I'm genuinely,
he has been better.
He's recently the better defender this year. Yeah. He's the better defender.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fender.
No, I mean, we're leaving ourselves in an awkward position, because we had this time where, with the flexibility of being able to play Sanchez, Alderweireld, and Vertonghen, it was an incredible setup, yeah, and team to watch in that shape. But since this injury and such a weirdness with his contract, that seems to have soured, and he's only really played against, what, Rochdale and stuff.
And he had a nightmare as well.
Yeah, it wasn't great.
The thing that does concern me about it is, I'm not going to adopt this kind of like, oh, it doesn't really matter if we sell him. It's a fucking huge blow. The guy is, you know, he's a class act, he is. And as much as I've kind of voiced the kind of, oh, you know, he hasn't adapted to Wembley that well, whatever, the guy's class act. Sanchez is brilliant. Sanchez, for his age, is absolutely fantastic. I do feel the past few games, he's maybe starting to show that he has played a few too many games, though. There's a few little kind of errors creeping into his game with a bit of regularity, which is going to come with a 21-year-old playing in a new league. This thing, Rob Holding is still held up as like this promising youngster. The guy's 24 years old now, you know?
I've got no fears over Sanchez at all. Even Foyth as well has been fantastic whenever he stepped in.
I quite like him as well, but a lot of people seem to say he's absolute gubbins when he comes on.
Who's that, one Foyth?
Yeah, no, which is bizarre.
He's always done really well whenever he's played.
Yeah, even people who I don't think are like particularly like mouth breathery type fans or anything. Of course, that's, you know, that's the all important opinion, mine. But I've seen, yeah, a real kind of divided opinion on Fife, but I really like him. I mean, he, again, is what, 18, 19?
Yeah, he's a kid. But he's got all the fundamentals, which is the important part.
Yeah, I like him.
I've looked
into the
Pochettino thing, by the way, and he'll have been there 4 years this year, which is the same as Redknapp and the same as Venables. But other than that, the longest serving before them is Keith Birkinshaw from 1976 to 1984. So 4 years is the top one. So if, you know, if he's still here next season, essentially, he's the longest serving Tottenham manager since the late 70s to mid 80s, which is
El Grande Queso,
which is ridiculous. Got one from Rowan Stewart. Dyer or Lamella, one stays, the other goes to Chelsea. Keep Lamella.
Yeah. Like, how many times can we go over this one? But like, Lamella's already, like, to me, he's showing his worth to the team already. You know, he's not starting every game, but when he comes on, he's effective. And
when he starts, he's effective as well.
Yeah, I'm so much happier having him on the bench, having more. Like, look at the options we have for the different types of games we play now. It still seems to be, and I think we were saying this like fucking years ago when we still had like Tom Huddlestone in the middle and we were debating as to who plays Palacios or Huddlestone, you know, as our defensive midfield option. And even then we were saying, why does it have to be either or? Why are we not approaching this like other big teams do and see that different players are suitable for different fixtures and different phases of different games? With Lamella, Moura, Eriksen, Ali, even Son, all of these players in this attacking band, they all have their own unique qualities. Why do we have to still be forced to choose between any of them? Why not be happy that we have all these players within our squad that when you look to our bench, you think, yeah, there's goals there now from everywhere. Whereas it was only, what, 2-3 years ago that it was literally, right, let's bring on Chadli and hope he scores. And that was it, you know? Yeah. I don't know. It's bizarre.
We've got one question here from Michael King. I think this is, we've run out of football once now, just checking.
Fuck football.
There's a lot of people who've asked about sort of why aren't we just shelling out for Toby? And I think, you know, your idea of there being more to it than money is probably the right one there. The one from Michael King is one that actually I agree with. The fact that according to Greg's Twitter poll, a quarter of people prefer the chicken bake over the steak bake, madness. I saw this and I had exactly the same feeling. I didn't know chicken bake was a thing. Like, I knew it existed, but I didn't know people liked it that much. Who's picking that over a steak bake?
Mate, I just want to know who's not having an artisan sourdough loaf with avocado mash.
90% of the country, I think, is the answer. But no, you know what I'm saying? Have you ever frequented a Greggs?
I believe I've tiptoed into one every now and again to see
by
what
accident.
The girls get up to. Yeah.
What's your usual order?
No. See, mate, the thing is, right, since Christmas, shedding for the wedding and all that, I've not actually eaten any bread, rice,
what?
Pasta, potato,
what,
no carbs.
What else is there in the diet?
It's high fat, high protein, no sugar. Basically, or very low sugar, so sugar from like natural sources.
So you're going to come out like a fucking stick at this wedding?
Mate, come on, behave. It's not, yeah. There's only so far it'll go, but, you know. But it's pretty decent at the moment. I do long for like pizza though.
That what your honeymoon's just going to be, you scarfing?
Yeah, basically.
Eat until you're like, sick, like a bulimic.
I'm going to be eating and eating and eating all the bread. All the bread. Like,
that's your wedding night is just you, Charlotte. I've ordered takeout.
Sorry, love. Not tonight.
There's a buffet around the corner.
You know that Simpsons when Homer like completely exhausts the all-you-can-eat
the sea place.
Yeah, and then when it goes to court and the judge is like, and when they told you you could you couldn't have any more or you could eat seafood, what did you do? And she's like, we went fishing. Yeah, there we go. That'll be me. But we're actually going to Argentina for the honeymoon.
Oh,
so I'm
all the meat.
Yeah, mate, I'm gonna come back like Pochettino does after a summer. You know, it's gonna be a summer of
with your tracksuit, not quite zipping.
Steaks and bread. Oh, mate, I love it. You know he enjoys himself. You know he enjoys himself over the summers.
His blood is 80% Malbec by the time he drinks.
It is, isn't it? That fucking Harry Kane article when he was like, I vividly recall after I scored my first hat trick, going into Pochettino's office and he was sat there with a big smile and an even bigger glass of Malbec. And you're just like, fucking yes, Poch, man. Like, I love that idea of him just being like that, you know, like an actual caricature of a like big Argy. Yeah.
Oh, dear. We've got a couple of pop culture ones. Have you got time to just knock off a few?
Yeah.
We've got one from Nathan Clark. Fought on Black Panther.
Ooh.
Because people want to hear from a white man about Black Panther.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Well,
no, do crack on.
I mean, it's hard, isn't it? Because there's two, as we spoke about with this, there's two angles to Black Panther whereby you can't, like, it's the same with the, like, so say, like, the Ghostbusters reboot.
Yeah.
Like, there's a clear and obvious, like, socio-political side and context to this film mm-hmm. that means it demands an extra sort of level of credence. On a sort of base level, my kind of thing is I'm not really that big on the Marvel films. I watch them and I enjoy them and I don't get that deeply.
By a rule, dislike them.
I don't mind them. This is the thing to me, I don't mind. I don't like them as much as Star Wars films.
I actively dislike Star Wars as well. So that's my
position. You do. And I also feel that, like, I think one of my, like, I think as a white man, but on that sort of plane.
I think the term we use in this context is colonizer.
Okay. And,
go on, Jack, as a colonizer.
Okay, as a colonizer. I do find, look, I'm going to be in trouble here probably, but I do find there's this certain level of, and I've spoken to you about it in private, of like white liberal who is fawning over a film like Black Panther, who is like, you know, everything about this film is, everything about this film is majestic. Everything about this film is brilliant. I saw people in the audience in traditional African dress and it was so wonderful. Mate, I fucking, you know, maybe it doesn't happen all the time, but I go to the cinema in London all the time. I always see people in traditional dress, like all around in London all the time. Like, don't make this such a big thing and don't be so patronising about it.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of my thing. But at the same time, yeah, I enjoy Black Panther. I thought it was a good film because I actually prefer the sort of the Marvel side stories a lot more than I do kind of like the main canon, if anything. I've actually enjoyed, like, I like Black Panther. I seem to be the only person that actually kind of liked Doctor Strange. I thought that was all right. I liked Ant-Man.
When they do sort of a genre film within that world, it's not too bad.
Like,
you know, Ant-Man was essentially a heist film, but they had some odd Marvel bits in and they had to foreshadow this bit and that bit there. I end up watching all of them, even though I don't like them, because my family really likes them, and there's not often we all go to the cinema together.
Well, and it's such a cultural event as well, whether you like them or not.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah, so it is one of those things where I do it with that in mind. And there are one or two that I don't mind. I actually, the one that I liked that nobody else seemed to like was the last Thor film, because it was just a toilet humour comedy. It wasn't actually a superhero film. It was a weird Taika Waititi film with Thor in it.
Well, you could tell he was just thinking, how far can I push this?
There was all sorts of stuff in that that was just shouldn't have been there. There's that one character he plays in CGI, which is not just comic relief, but actively is there to undermine the film and every sort of serious element of it, which I liked. But I adored Black Panther.
There's a really good, so the Empire podcast, they do these special ones called spoiler specials where they'll only tell you to listen to it if you've actually seen the film, because they'll talk at length about different bits.
Oh, that sounds generally interesting.
Yeah, they'll generally talk with somebody from the production as well, and they actually have the director on that.
Okay.
And he's basically saying it to that effect. He's like, look, fuck it. Like, I wrote this script being like, they're going to scale back 70% of this, but they didn't. And so I was like, fucking jackpot, and just kind of went with it. So it's,
I think because that second Thor film was so shit, they had to do something to it.
It was garbage, wasn't it?
Yeah. What was it called? Thor the Dark World or something?
I don't know.
One of the worst things I've ever seen in my life, and I never wish to see it again.
But what did you make of Black Panther? Anyway,
I loved it. For me, the most interesting part of it was Killmonger, because, you know, by rights, he's not wrong. There was one point where he was in that fake British Museum, where the woman says something to him about where the hammer came from. And he turns around and goes, and where exactly do you think your ancestors got it from? And she had that look on her face, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. I wasn't expecting this. But no, I really enjoyed it. I think the themes and sort of the way it was done was fantastic. And I've written and spoken about it in the past when I was a kid, that the reason I love the basketball and NBA so much is when I was sort of 5 or 6, or when 1997 Space Jam came out, so I'll have been five. When I saw Michael Jordan on the screen for the first time, I think that's the first time I ever saw a black superhero. You know, his arm stretches from half court and dunks on a team of aliens, and I was like, who the fuck is this? What is this that's going on here? Because I've never been exposed or seen anything like it before in my life. And for me, knowing that there's going to be kids now who've seen this and have got this in their life that, you know, when I grew up I'd never had or never saw, is fantastic. And I think that you're right, there are two ways to look at it, because the third act's pretty gash. At the end of it, it is just CGI characters kicking shit out of each other, and that's what happens at the end of each and every one of these films. But for 90% of it, it's so much better. I mean, the Dora Milaje, and, you know, but the fact that it's not just inclusive in terms of race, but in gender as well, and sort of pushes how sort of matriarchal that society can be and what have you.
Was
fantastic, and we're both people that come from female-led homes and houses, so it's not as if we're unfamiliar with that. So it's, I think all over the park, it was fantastic. I think that Ryan Coogler is just on one of the great directorial tears from first film to where he is now. And I can't wait to see where he goes, because I think he's going to be fantastic, and he already is, but he's going to get even better.
Fruitvale Station, for anybody that hasn't seen it, is one to
It's outstanding. And that's like his first film. So he's still learning what he's doing. I think, he's going to be fantastic. And just everyone that's in it, the performances and stuff, and the jokes that are in it, and the fact that, you know, you've got the CGI bloke making jokes about SoundCloud rap and stuff like that, fantastic. And, you know, the whole side story with M'Baku and the guys in the mountains made me laugh so much. And, you know, when he's making monkey noises at Martin Freeman for talking and shit, it's just it's stuff like that I didn't expect them to do. And Killmonger's last line, what's he say? I'd rather die now. I'd rather be thrown off the ship than to die in chains like my ancestors, something like that. And it's like, that's far more pointed than I ever expected a Marvel film to be. And, you know, in this day and age, it's needed as well. So I think it's one of those films which is, as you say, is bigger than what it's supposed to be. But, you know, it's all the better for it.
Yeah.
Duke Silver has asked us if we've seen Atlanta, which, of course, I'm up to date with the second season, but you've seen the first season as well.
I have. I didn't even know there was a second season.
Yeah, it's like four episodes in. You catch up. It's been absolutely fantastic.
Sick.
But yeah, thoughts on Atlanta? I mean, I banged on about this for like a good year before you caught up with it. So you've watched it the first season more recently.
We've done a big bit on this, haven't we? Before, that was basically just like watch it immediately.
Yeah, it's just, there's nothing else like it on television. It is the best thing on TV for me.
The thing for me is like, is just stick with it. Because the thing is, I enjoyed it. I was thinking at first, right, so this is basically like hip hop's version of Entourage, right? The first couple of episodes, I was going to be like, okay, it's a fairly kind of like sort of coming of age buddy kind of drama that's quite funny. It's got a bit of social commentary to it. Interesting. And then probably about episode, about halfway through episode three, from episode four onwards, it goes full fucking just batshit Twin Peaks. Like, what the fuck is this? Like the original storyline doesn't even really matter anymore towards the end of it. It's hardly anything to do with it. And the whole thing is just a subversive, like, multi-genred, artsy, but massively entertaining kind of, I don't know, just it, the gun is pointed in all directions. Because again, it's not, for, you know, for any of our Brexit contingent who still do listen to this, that think it's just this kind of social justice warrior snowflake signaling, the gun by Glover is turned in all directions. It's turned on everybody. It's turned on himself. It's turned on his peers. It's turned on anything you can imagine. So just watch it.
Yeah, anybody can enjoy it. I mean,
it's
this season, because they know what they are and they know that people know what they are, they don't ease you into it like they did first season. So the first episode of this year has one of the great cameos ever by Cat Williams, who's as problematic a character as you can find, but he's essentially playing himself, and it's just one of the great turns in a you know, scene stealing performance, because I don't want to spoil it, but there's an alligator involved and shit like that where they shouldn't be. And there's one bit, my favorite character, as you know, is Darius, Lakeith Stanfield's character. Lakeith Stanfield, by the way, I think is another generational talent. Have you seen the trailer for his new film, the one where he works in a call center?
No, I haven't at all.
I'll send you it afterwards. It looks ridiculous. It's supposed to be sort of the big sleeper hit of this year, but I'll send you the link to it afterwards. But just the one-off lines that his character have me creasing to the point where I have to pause it while I watch it. Because there's one bit in the opening episode about Florida Man. And he goes, do you know why all the headlines start with Florida Man? You know, like Florida Man kills six people or shoots unarmed black teenager. And instead of it just being like a point, he winds it out into this story about there being just one bad guy in Florida called Florida Man who goes around doing all of it. And while he sort of is explaining who Florida Man is, there's like a cutscene of Florida Man doing all these things in the most grotesque manner possible. It's genuinely brilliant. I had to watch that like three times before I could move on.
I like that.
But it's just the construct of, you know, how headlines are made. So Florida Man 27 does this or whatever. It's just genius.
It's just it's you know, like from the talk show episode in the first series,
the show within a show.
Yeah, it's just that the one guy, the guy that wants to transition to being a white guy, and you see the black guy talking to the police officer, and he just walks past. That's him, officer. That's the guy. I called them.
This last episode good. As well was one of the ones where they just got a little bit of money and they're trying to spend some of it, and they're finding it even more difficult with money than they were without it, because people don't want to take money from them. And it's one of those things where you sat there and you go, oh shit, I know some of this stuff, like people holding notes to the light when somebody else has just spent a 20 behind you, and they're like, oh, accept it, fine. But if you give them the same thing, then they'll act differently around you and stuff. Is absolutely fantastic. But yeah, if you've not seen it, find it, because it's genuinely a work of genius, and I'm not sure there are many shows as good as that on television at present.
Watch Gamora as well, then, mate.
I've not seen it yet. I've heard good things about it, but I've not yet seen it.
It's good. It's good.
Shall I tell you what I've been watching that is also good? You know how I do a turn in things that you wouldn't expect me to watch?
Oh, yeah.
It's
not Grace and Frankie, is it, or something like that?
No, it's not, but I've been tempted.
I knew it. I don't know why. When I saw that, I was like, I bet Baines has had a look at this, I might have a go.
You know how much I love a shit thing that I shouldn't be watching. But I've been watching The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon, and mate, it's fucking class.
Writing,
it's written by the same woman who wrote Gilmore Girls. You know how much of
a warm
appreciation I have for that television programme. Genuinely, it's about a woman in, what was it, the 40s or 50s, a Jewish woman in New York who husband leaves her and she decides to do stand-up. But it's genuinely really, really good. It's really well acted. It's got Rachel Brosnahan in, who is the woman in House of Cards that Doug was obsessed with. But it's just got, it's so well written and really funny and sort of a really good sort of just piece that shouldn't really exist and only exists because streaming exists. But it won loads of awards at the Golden Globes and I'd already heard about it because I knew the person who'd written it and from Gilmore Girls. And I was like, oh, I'm interested in this, but it seems a bit of a strange thing to have done. I don't imagine Amazon will pick this up or what have you. And then it won loads and it's sort of like the banner thing for them now, especially with the way Transparent's gone after Jeffrey Tambor's been sacked and what have you. So it's a big thing for them and it's well worth digging up. I think one that you and your missus can watch together because I think Charlotte will like it as well. But it is genuinely hilarious and it's one of those things that is fantastic.
Look at that.
Have you got anything? You not watching anything shit? Because I know you end up watching stuff like, what's that musical one you watched where is it Crazy Ex-Girlfriend or something like that?
Yeah, watched the first couple of series of that and then I just couldn't be arsed with the third.
Yeah.
Sort of, yeah. It was all right. It was okay. But the third series just didn't really grip me. We're actually watching The Defenders at the moment.
What's that?
The Marvel stuff. You know,
oh,
you
the Netflix like ones. I've got all them in my list. I've just not had the time to watch them.
It's so Defenders is the one that's like all of them when they've all come together, like this new
Netflix
Avengers. Bollocks. Yeah,
isn't there one that's supposed to be really dog shit? Which is the dog shit one, the fist punch guy?
Iron Fist.
That's the one.
I didn't think it was by any means good. It was definitely the weakest of all of them. But I think it's again, it's one of those things where like people over egg how bad it is, in my opinion, anyway. I don't think it's like as much a war.
Which is the one to start with? Is it Jessica Jones the best one or that Luke Cage or what have you?
I think the actual chronology.
No, not in chronological order, but as in what's the best one to start with? Daredevil's first season was supposed to be good as well, wasn't it? I forgot about it.
It was really good. I don't know. They're all really good in their own right. I think, personally speaking, overall on balance, I enjoyed Luke Cage the most.
Okay.
And then, but it's between Luke Cage and Jessica Jones for me. Luke Cage probably sealed it because I just like the soundtrack. There's a lot of sort of like old school hip hop on it. So
oh, cool.
It's kind of, yeah, sort of does it for me. Put a bit of Wu-Tang in there and I'm there.
I'm just looking through my Netflix list at the moment and there's so much shit in there that I haven't seen. Annihilation's on there. I really want to watch that. I can't believe they've not put that in cinemas.
It's fucking Alex Garland, man. After he's just done Ex Machina, like
yeah. Apparently, people thought it was going to be too brainy for audiences. Which
probably
I,
is.
I just don't. Yeah, I mean, but
I saw enough people groaning in fucking Blade Runner. So.
But I mean, after how well Arrival did, I thought people would be after the next Arrival. And if you pitched it as that, then people would go and watch it.
People stink.
Yeah, true. I tell you what, I did watch on Netflix recently. Having just seen continue watching or whatever, is that bad original Netflix romantic comedy When We First Met.
Which one's that?
It's got the girl from my viewing habits. Really, there should be an invention. But it's got the girl from like Baywatch and
okay.
Alex.
Is it good?
It's so bad that it is good. It is genuinely terrible. It's one of those things where if you've got nothing else to watch and you're sort of just looking for... I watched it before bed on a Sunday. You know when you have of Sunday evening, just like, oh, I don't feel like doing anything. I want to disengage my brain before the next week starts. And I saw it there as like one of the top recommended things on my Netflix. And I was like, fuck it, I'll watch it. And I happily got along with it, like, just, you know, giggled along and fucking, you know, knew what was going to happen from about 10 minutes in. But it's one of those high concept rom-coms that I think if you're into that sort of thing and you have a penchant for them, then you'll be all right. It's almost as if it's a bit of a rip-off of, Midnight in Paris.
Yeah.
Sort of that sort of time travel-y sort of idea. Okay. Which there is, you know, comedy to be had within that. There is one bit, there was one belly laugh for me. But other than that, they were sort of just titters. But it's worth watching.
I'll tell you a quick one. Have you watched, on a very different note, have you watched Icarus yet?
Yes, the documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that.
I like the documentary itself. Like it was fairly well made. It was you know, it was all right. But the thing I just found like astonishing about it is how it's literally like a guy who's gone from like wanting to make a documentary about his own kind of cycling that he's. So for anyone that hasn't seen it, and for anyone that hasn't heard about it, it's basically an amateur cyclist - documentary maker who he does every year. He basically does the amateur Tour de France, and he's pretty decent. He comes 15th, but he sees that there's a gap between himself and perhaps the five riders above of him, and then between those five and the top 10, a huge gulf. And he wants to basically do an experiment on himself as to how much doping can push him up the rankings for the next year. So he goes down a path to find somebody that can help him dope using Lance Armstrong's technique. However, what happens over the course of him just making this documentary has basically changed the world. Has like, is everything that you see today now in terms of like, not everything, but a lot of what you're seeing at the moment now with regard to the Olympics, with Russian doping, with doping in sports in general, has kind of had everybody sort of knew it was there under the surface, but he's almost like knocked the top of the pussy head off of this and fucking let it out into the ether. And it's just that journey, seeing how it goes from nothing to that, I found really pretty incredible, pretty amazing. That guy, the Russian guy, is so gonna end up dead, if not dead already as well. Like, he's dead.
Yeah.
He just is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Watch it.
It's really nice. It is really, really good. And it's far more worthy than anything I've suggested to watch.
I did see the guy. I did find the guy, the main guy, not the Russian guy, the American guy.
Yeah.
Or Canadian, whatever it is. I found it really irritating, though.
Yeah, it's one of those things where people in documentaries sometimes do come off like that because you spend so much time with them.
Yeah.
Can we just take 2 seconds to say, fuck the Shape of Water, please? Because I haven't said it enough in print, so I wanted to say it in a different audio format as well.
It's kind of one of those things, you know, like when I think but correct me if I'm wrong, was Scorsese's first Oscar, was it for The Departed?
Yes.
And so I kind of...
It's like, because they didn't give it Goodfellas, didn't they give it Dancers with Wolves that year or something like that?
Something like that. And I mean, Departed was a good film, but it wasn't
Scorsese's pastiche.
Yeah. So it's almost like, I do wonder if with this, they're just giving Guillermo del Toro an Oscar.
Yeah, it's their turn. Same with Alice and Janney as well, because all she did in that film was be Alice and Janney. There was nothing remarkable about her performance. It was just her being her in a role written specifically for her to be her, which really pissed me off because I thought, was it Laurie Metcalf who was in Lady Bird, was 10 times the actress. That bit where she drives around the airport absolutely fucking killed me.
Sad, isn't it, man?
It's really, such a great film. Affecting. Greta Gerwig should have won Best Director for me. Just because I thought for that to be her directorial debut, the strength was in the directing, whereas the strength in Get Out was in the writing.
Yeah.
That's where it should have been. Get Out was my Best Picture nominee. I was really annoyed that it was Kinship or what, because
she'll get there, Gerwig.
Yeah.
Shape of Water for me is like, the thing is, you know, like, I didn't think Shape of Water was a bad film. I thought there was decent imagination there, and I thought it was like an all right adult's fairy tale. But that's it. There was no depth to it. And as much as people say, oh no, it shows these stories about it's a metaphor for marginalized people in society. Well, you've got actual fucking films about marginalized people in society. Call Me by Your Name or Get Out or even fucking Lady Bird, yeah. You know? So like, let's, you know, are we in that sadder place whereby people find it easier to fucking empathize with a giant lizard man with a dick that comes out from behind a fucking shell that's in his lap rather than like actually marginalized people? Because like, come on, that can't be the reason something wins a fucking Oscar. Like, if that, like, you know, just...
It's one of those films where I think that stupid people think it's smarter than it is. I know that sounds very elitist, but sometimes thick people think things are smarter
When's
than they
ever
actually
stopped
are.
You before, me?
No, you know when you call me a snob sometimes, just remind me of when I say things like this. But it is. It's a smart film for thick people. Because the themes and the sort of the points it wants to make and so heavily layered on and gone over and telegraphed that there's no subtlety to that film at all.
A fish man fucks
a deaf woman, and I get that that's, you know, progress, if that's what we want to call bestiality.
And she's got like a gay neighbor and this kind of stuff.
Gay neighbor.
Like, you know, it's like, it's not about, there's more nuance in
one scene of either Get Out or Lady Bird, and there's more intelligence and thought and heart in those films than the fish fucking film, which I just didn't get on board with. I think because I was already so won over by Get Out and Lady Bird, and I'd seen them before, and to be honest, the premise of The Shape of Water fucked me off, because there's not... I don't want to watch the fish sex film, but because I'd seen every other Best Picture film and sort of I had a day or two before the Oscars and I stay up and watch them every year like a sad act, I was like, for the sake of completism, I'll watch it just on the off chance that it wins me over. But it just annoyed me further that people liked it as much as they did.
Right.
I annoyed you as well by... What did I refer to... Paul Thomas Anderson,
you said,
film.
Phantom Thread.
Phantom Thread.
Daniel Day-Lewis does a funny voice and a bit of sewing. You fucking arsehole. It's a brilliant film.
You texted me that back about four times as well.
I simmered on it for about half hour and then I started pissing myself and then I think sent it back to you just being like, you fucking arsehole.
It's a really good film. Yeah. It's not the best Paul Thomas Anderson film ever. It's not the greatest Daniel Day-Lewis film ever. It's certainly a better film than The Shape of Water, but I think I was kicking off about The Shape of Water winning, I think, at that point. And he was like, oh, maybe Phantom Thread should have won. And I was like, I was in a mood by that point.
No. Right. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the episode, you jackals. You just can't get enough content, can you? But we probably, we will try and do them with more regularity towards the end of the season.
We'll be back before the FA Cup final.
It's interesting now.
I hope we win the FA Cup.
Just quickly. Yeah. Will we win the FA Cup?
Mm. Will we win it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Will we finish in the top four?
Yes.
Let's fucking have it then. Come on, you Spurs. You know all the other bits. Listen to us, follow us on Twitter, blah, blah, blah.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.